Thursday, the 18th of December, Kof Aleph Kislev, Rabbi Jeremy Conway, Kashrus in the World of Food Technology.
Good morning, Mirai, Bosai. Thank you for inviting me back to the Torah Way. I've spoken several times, and people have always asked me to speak about Kashrus, and I've always refused. Personally, I prefer not to be entirely a one policy politician or a one mitzvah rabbi, and this is an opportunity for me to speak and look into other inyonim. But more importantly, this particular talk is more of a lecture than a shiur. I usually do it with a PowerPoint presentation, and therefore I don't know how easily it will adapt to a half hour shiur in the morning, but Ratzono shel Adam Zeh Kavodoy, Kosha Omer Chava Avayet Haseh, that's what people have asked for, so that's what I'll give you this morning. I am reminded of the famous speaker and historian Rabbi Beryl Wein, who was asked to speak at an annual dinner for some Choshev Yeshiva, and when they picked him up in the car, he asked them, how is it that what's up that you've asked me to come and be your speaker for this big dinner? They said to him, listen Rabbi, you know, every year we have a big rabbi, Roshi, Yeshiva, every year it's Torah, Torah, Torah. This year we thought we'd have something a little bit different. So it's a sort of a backhanded compliment for a rabbi. I think my presentation this morning will be more in the category of something a little bit different. But let's start with a little bit of Torah, Torah, Torah. I find it fascinating that Kashrus, which is a chuk, is also the source for one of the most powerful proofs of Torah min HaShemayim. Famous Gemara Chulin Nun Tes Amud Aleph, where I can bring with me the Pesukim, it's got a Chumash. Chumash Parsha Shmini, of course, is the whole parsha about Kashrus. It's a long parsha, and there the main principles of Kashrus are very clearly laid out. You've got to have cloven and hooves and chew the card, and then the Pesukim go on and say, Ach, is there lo-so-chlu? However, these you may not eat from Mali Agelum and Mafrisi Apalsof, and those who only chew the card or only have cloven and hooves. And it goes through the various ones. There's our Gomol, there's our Shofon, there's our Oneves, the camel and the hyrax and the rock, the badger, whatever it may be. There's a Chazir, the well-known Chazir, Ki Mafris Parso V'Shesa Shesa Parso V'Geira Lo Yigor. It has cloven hooves. It doesn't chew the cub. And Chazal say, Ach Eser Lo Seichlu, only these you may not eat, only these. There are only four exceptions. Out of the entire gamut of literally thousands of different species of animals, these are the only four. And that is in fact not only brought in the Gemara, but even Paskin in the Rambam and in Shulchan Aruch, if you were to be walking through the Midbar and you come across an animal which has cloven hooves and you don't know whether it's chewing the cud or not, it's as starving as you are, you're in the middle of a wilderness and it's not chewing the cud, you happen to have your shechita knife with you, you know how to do shechita, you know it's got cloven hooves, and you know it's not the pig, you can shecht it, you can eat it, because the Torah says, Acher zeh lo seichlu, there's only one exception. Of all the tens of thousands of species, only one exception, and that's the chazir, which has cloven hooves and doesn't chew the cud. Any other animal which has cloven hooves, it must chew the cud as well, and that you can shecht in its kosher. Ach Esther, only these. And the Gemara says, V'chi Moshe, kenigi hoya, blistery hoya, was Moshe a zoologist? Was Moshe a trapper or a hunter? How does Moshe Rabbeinu know that this is the only exception? And of course, it's a completely bizarre thing to write down in the Torah with all your gewaldiger wisdom, to write down and say this is the only, there are only four exceptions, and then the next day or next day or in the hundreds of years to come they'll discover other behemoths which have one simon, not the other simon. Mikan Raya, the Torah min HaShemayim. This is obviously a clear proof that the Torah comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam, because the Ribbono Shel Olam, the one who created the entire world and all the animals and put them all in the world, is an easy thing for him to say, and you should know that there are some exceptions to these, all of these are the only four exceptions. But no other fellow, no human, and certainly an intelligent human, would ever write such a thing. The Kan Raya, the Torah min HaShemayim, is a beautiful raya to the Yesod, or Yesodos of our entire lives, from this mitzvah of Kashrus. And it goes a little bit further, because this is the raya that the Torah should be chsav. Torah Min HaShemayim. But I heard the most interesting thought also on Torah Shebaal Peh, because the Pesukim go on to say, when it comes to the fish, that there's also a particular siman, and the siman is Kol Asher Lo Snapir the Kaskeses Mamayim. Anything which has got fins and scales, those are the kosher fish. And because Chazal say it's a Mishnah in Nidor Nunala from the base, that everything which has scales has fins. Everything which has scales has got fins. So therefore, why does it say everything with scales, therefore it's kosher? Why do you have to say kosher is snapir the kaskeses? Just stick with the kaskeses, you don't need the snapir. So says the Gemara, Tandavei Rabbi Yishmael, Yagdil Torah of the Yadir. It's not entirely clear what he means with Yagdil Torah of the Yadir. The Poshet Peshat seems to be that this, it comes to teach you the greatness of Torah, that the Torah knew that actually you only need kaskeses, but by the way, anything which has got kaskeses has got fins as well. But in that case, it didn't need to tell it. It didn't need to say it. So I once heard that this is also part of this Mekan Raya L'Torah Min HaShemayim. Chazal come out with this extraordinary statement, which is an extremely risky statement. Actually, it's a more risky statement than even the previous statement of Achazel L'Torah Levi's is the only four exceptions. To say this rule that anything which has got scales has got fins, and there are thousands and thousands of species of fish which have just been discovered to this day. People go fishing today in unusual seas, and they come up with new species the whole time. You may have seen recent articles, I think even this week in the newspaper, of new species which have been discovered. Unusual new species, because there are literally thousands, tens of thousands of different species of fish. And yet Chazal come out with this extraordinary statement and saying you should know, you don't need to look for fins. As a halacha, you don't need to look for fins, you only need to look for scales, because everything which has got scales has got fins. Here is the Gevaldik Arayah that the Torah Shebaal Peh also is Min HaShemayim, otherwise Chazal should never come out with such a thing. On this subject, time is extremely limited when you're giving the Torah away. Share the questions afterwards. You should be aware, however, having mentioned this, that it's not quite so straightforward. Everything which has scales has fins, because there are, say, the ichthyologists, the fish scientists, tell us that there are four different types of scales: stenoid, cycloid, ganoid, and placoid. And only stenoid and cycloid are kosher scales, not ganoid and placoid. Not that in the Mishnah it says anything about stenoid and cycloid and ganoid, but what it does say in Halacha is there have to be scales which come off very easily, which are scales which are really separate pieces, which are just coating the flesh, and not those which are protuberances of bone or part of the growth of the flesh which do not come off. And that's why scales, ganoid scales, like scales on a crocodile skin or a snake skin, those are not kosher kinds of scales. Have to be scales which actually remove very easily, and they come off, as we all know, in many kosher fish. When you're washing them, they come off in your hands, or they scrape off easily with the back of a knife. There are fish which a fishmonger might tell you have scales, like skates, for example, which actually, in fact, they're not stenoid or cycloid scales, not the kind of scales which come off very easily. So if you are buying fish in a foreign clime, you want to know whether they're kosher, I'm not going to have to say, excuse me, can I please just pluck a few scales off your fish? They come off easily, then you know they are kosher. And for that reason, we always insist in the Beis Din that a shomer, that any licensee, a restaurant or a caterer, has to get fish delivered with skin attached. Has to be actual skin attached, so you can see whether there are scales on there or not. Quite a popular dish nowadays is tuna loins. It's a big piece of tuna. It looks actually like meat. It's red colour, can be dark red colour. And not the entire fish has scales. You only need one scale, actually, to be a kosher fish. But, and the body of the tuna does not have scales all over. Where must we do? We have to get a piece of fish which has got the scales on it, which is visible. Even then, we've had interesting experiences. Somebody once put his hand into a bowl, into a bag of fish, a shomer, and he got bitten. He pulled his thing out in a hurry, and a little crab hanging on the end of his finger, because the salmon very often, when they're farmed, are actually fed on crabs, and somehow here a little crab got in together with the fish. Mm-hmm. But the parasha continues through the issue of the birds. Birds we only eat by Masorah, and that issue of what is the Masorah, what it is, the Torah doesn't tell you a kalal, fins and scales or chewing the kalal, whatever it may be. It only tells you these are the 20 birds which are not kosher, and how we translate them, whether it's the bearded kite or the osprey, whatever it may be, is a matter of debate amongst the Mephoroshim over the years. We only eat birds which we have al pi Masorah, And there's a big shaila whether we have a Masorah on turkey, for example, and sparrows and all the interesting things. That's another drasha. And then the Torah goes on to insects and how makbid we are not to consume any insects. The al titamu vohem with its mesem bomb, they bring tumah upon you, it's gadashem, yisem kadoshim, etc., etc. That all seems very straightforward. Kashrus today is not like that. You go to the supermarket, you're not looking at pins and scales or chewing the cards, you're looking at E numbers, E120, E471, E572, whatever it may be. And the task of a kashrus agency, authority, today, is really to interpret those age-old klolim from the psukim and from Chazal into the E numbers and ingredients and manufacturing processes of today. You may think it's to do with politics, you may think it's to do with finance, not to do with any of these things, although there is today a lot of finance involved in kashrus. People keep eating, people need to eat more lavish and more unusual kind of products, and there's more and more production and more hechsherim. All these things have to be paid for, and it's something which Hamoin and Balabatim should be aware of, that there is a financial aspect to this as well. And it's Dover Poshet, I don't think I'm saying anything out of place, that a private Rav is putting the money in his pocket, if that is what's happening. It certainly does happen across the world in many, many cases. Nias Dati can't possibly be as good a Heksha as a Heksha belonging to a Kehillah, when the Rav or the Dayan giving the Heksha, if it's properly structured, is not in any way no Ger B'Dover. He has no commitment and he's not relying on that money, he gets his salary. The process of giving a heksha to products which are manufactured goes back a long way. Actually, I have, when I give my PowerPoint presentations, I like to dig out, show a slide, which is actually a kosher certificate from the court of the chief rabbi. Interestingly, the Beis Din in this country, the London Beis Din, I should say, I think is the oldest continuous Beis Din in the world. Certainly in Europe, for all sorts of obvious reasons. The Beis Din in Europe were destroyed and some of them were re-established in more recent years. The Beis Din has a continuous existence going back to the early 1700s, 1709. We find already a reference to the London Beis Din. Resettlement in this country when Oliver Cromwell allowed the Inn back in 1656. By 1709, we already have a record, the earliest records on the Beis Din we have. Interestingly, the Pinkerton of the Beis Din going back at least 150 years, handwritten records of all the cases which took place in the Beis Din. I would like to say it's not possible. If you live in the country and you don't know what you can eat, what you can't eat, you've got to have a Beis Din, you've got to have an authority. So with less than 50 years, you already find the establishment of a Beis Din. I had this letter, it's a rather nice letter, for those of you who've got good eyesight, you can just see, obviously, it's a picture of a Marmite jar, and it's actually a letter from the chief rabbi himself, Hermann Adler, in 1904. Nice, he uses the Hebrew date, 5664, doesn't use the English date, but it's equivalent to 1904. Dear sir, in reply to your letter, I have to state, you can safely use Marmite, which has the seal of the Beis Din. Kosher l'chol ha'shana chutz mepesach, vishim gemach simatoiva, I remain your faithfully Hermann Adler. It's very interesting, very nice to me, that the chief rabbi single-handedly, but more than other responsibilities, was writing back to everybody who wanted to know whether something was kosher. I've got 22 people working in the office today, never mind people out in the field. And the chief rabbi obviously was Osik in doing these things single-handedly. So this is an example. Once you've got a manufactured product, how can you eat it? Unless somebody is investigating, they didn't have E-numbers yet, but unless somebody is investigating what all the ingredients and manufacturing processes are. My second slide, which I show in this Indian, is to show that it goes back a lot further than that, because here is a kosher certificate from the 12th century. 12th century kosher certificate, which actually I came across on a visit to the Cairo Geniza. Cairo Geniza, you've probably all heard of, absolutely famous, fascinating repository of ancient documents, because there was a shul in Cairo where all the shameless used to be, if they were putting them in a box and then taking down to the Brunners, they used to post them in to a little room of covered under the stairs, and eventually when that room got full, it was bricked up. And the shul stayed there for hundreds of years, for centuries, nobody even realized that behind the wall there was an extra room, quite a big room, full from top to bottom with old documents. Everything. Shtiklach from Rishonim, Sidurim, Birchas Hamazon, Tfilas, letters, shopping lists, kashrus certificates, all sorts of things are in there. Tens of thousands of documents. Solomon Schechter, beginning of the last century, discovered this hoard, brought it all back to Cambridge. You can visit. Absolutely, really, really fascinating to see that. And amongst the things was a kosher certificate. Shtar kashrus. Facsimile of a 12th century certificate signed by various rabbis confirming that the 339 cheeses being sold by Yefes ben Meshulam are kosher according to rabbinic law. So, once you've got a manufactured product, Somebody has to say, this is an apple, you know what it is. This has got crimson and scales, choose the cud, cloven hooves, you know what it is. This is manufactured, how do you know it is not? Somebody has to testify to that effect. When we try to investigate products for our testimonial, the first thing we look at, obviously, is the ingredients. And you should know, apart from the numbers, we have to know what the translation is and what they're actually referring to. There are many ingredients today which come from animal sources. Unusual for companies to put animal fat on their packets, but they will say things like glycerine, polysorbate, stearic acid, diacetin, triacetin, emulsifiers are extremely common, ubiquitous in almost any product you look at, and these can still be of animal origin. There can be products of fish origin, and of course if they're fish, we don't know what kind of fish they came from. Fish oil is still very common. Some people believe that fish oils are very healthy. Omega-3 oils very often come from fish, can come from trace sources as well, and one has to investigate whether one can be confident that they come from kosher fish. Believe it or not, there are many ingredients, several ingredients, which come from insect origin. And we've seen briefly the psukim, how much bitter we have to be. We know how we check, and we fruits and vegetables to ensure there's nothing of insect origin. One of the classics is cochineal. Cochineal is the red color. E120, it's very hard to remember all the E numbers, but this particular one is easy to remember because generally speaking in Jewish parlance 120 is a good number, so they didn't design 120, and an E number is a very bad one. Incidentally, everything beginning with a 1 is a colour. 120 is cochineal, which is derived from the cochineal beetle, also known as carmine. It comes from the cochineal beetle. It's an ancient colour. It was around, I think, in the time of the Romans, and it's very popular today because it's a natural colour. And lots of products used to be made with an artificial colour, and now they make it with a natural colour, and therefore there are things which came off the London based in Kashrus Guide list, such as Wrigley's Hubba Bubba chewing gum, or other things which I'm sure you used to partake of on a regular basis, and Smarties, and many other examples, pillow fruits, many other examples. E120, the product became non-kosher because they wanted to be able to put on the slogan, now using only natural colours. Natural colour sounds a lot healthier, but as I like to say, if they would say now using squashed beetle juice, it might not be quite as popular. But these things change, and interestingly enough, as I said, it's an ancient colour, it's discussed already in Epistrei Tshuva, in Yeridea. There are those who are Mati, I think Michal Yitzchok, the Invites also had a Tshuva about using this red colour in days gone by where they didn't have all the artificial colours in the sausages and things. Yesh lo dun, but the minhag nowadays certainly is not to use something like that in a kosher product. Another interesting ingredient of insect origin is shellac. Those who've got very good memories might recall that the first talk I gave here about honey also dealt with touched on the issue of shellac, because shellac, which is used as a glaze, they call it sometimes confection of glaze, a glaze over the outside of a chocolate. So for example, if you have chocolate raisins, and you see a nice shiny glaze on the outside, a kind of varnish. That varnish, usually most times, is shellac. Shellac is an excretion of the lac insect. The lac insect is certainly not kosher. What about this kind of resin which it produces, and it exudes, and you take it, and you purify it, and you use it as a resin to cover a kind of polish? There used to be a slogan with certain Maltesers, as you may remember them from years gone by, melts in the mouth and not in the hand. Why does it melt in the hand? Because it's covered with a glaze. That glaze, the Rosh has got a long tshuva, actually must do it at the end of the day. He's got 6 different reasons, a very fascinating tshuva. But the Lachatchila, Tasha's agency today giving the product with a heksha, would not usually use something which is dubious and questionable. Although I had a very interesting experience many years ago, might be the best part, 20 years ago, where I went to a factory to check out, actually it was a kind of lift product, some sort of lemon tea powder. In this same factory, they did a range of different things. And one of the things they did was chocolate raisins. And we were listing their chocolate raisins in our kosher guide as non-kosher, because at that time, we've changed our policy actually, because of this incident. But at that time, we used to list even things in the kosher guide which contained a shellac, even though, as I say, yesh ladun, different opinions. We had it down as non-kosher. And I discovered he was making there a chocolate raisin for a Hirsha company with a Haredi Hirsha, and they're making them exactly the same way. We were listing the product with non-kosher, and they were giving a nice Haredi hechsher to it. And after discussion in the Beis Din, whilst we didn't agree with giving of a Haredi hechsher containing shellac, but since Rav Moshe is Matir, Rav Padua also has a tshuva about it, there's plenty of room to be made. We were actually make over the Kashrus guide on shellac. You need to know that there's many ingredients which come from all sorts of different sources. A classic ingredient is alcohol. Spirit vinegar is made from alcohol. Other ingredients can be made from alcohol. Alcohol is used very often. You may think, it's only something which you down with a piece of herring on a Shabbos morning, but in fact it's used as a diluent to do extractions on flavors, on colors. Sometimes it remains in the product. Can be very common. And as I say, ethanol, spirit vinegar is obviously common in products. Interesting that something like alcohol, pure ethyl alcohol, ethanol, can come from five different sources. It can come from petroleum, because it's not a problem for us, not usually used in the food industry, but it does sometimes slip in with lower grade ingredients, and particularly when you're making ingredients like flavors and things for Pesach, and you want to avoid any kind of shilas, if you use something of petroleum origin, it's certainly not going to be a problem as far as kashrus is concerned. Obviously it can come from wine origin, in which case it's going to be non-kosher. It can be fermentation either of wheat, in which case if it's fermentation of wheat then you've got a problem of chametz for Pesach, and it can come from fermentation of sugar beet, which it should be kosher l'chol adeh, as long as they haven't got any other interesting ingredients. And it can also, the fifth source is from milk, believe it or not. There are actually, fortunately, only two factories in the world, one in Ireland, Carberry, which is actually under certification of the Basin, and one is another factory in Australia. And there, after they've extracted everything else out of the milk they can get out, the protein, which is the casein, and the lactose, and the whey, and all the different other ingredients which can be extracted, you're left with 97% water. And what do you do with all this water? It's a big problem. And there's still a little bit, a small amount of minerals and proteins in there. So somebody came up with the idea of concentrating it and evaporating it, concentrating it, and then through fermentation process, turning it into alcohol. Actually, it proved to be extremely expensive, and they told me they'd never build a plant like that again. But nevertheless, they produce alcohol out of milk. Some years ago, there was a whole scare when suddenly everybody was saying that vodka was milchik. There was a problem with vodka being milchik, and all the Lubavitchers obviously got themselves in a terrible tizzy about it. I'm sorry to say that I was actually the source of that rumour. Certainly wasn't my fault, because I met Rav Lando Shita of Bnei Brak in a factory in Ireland in the afternoon, in Coca-Cola concentrate factory actually, just after I'd come from the Carberry factory in the morning. I told him it was the most interesting thing. I've just discovered they're making alcohol out of milk in this factory, etc. Very interesting shaila. It's mei cholov. For those of you who have seen the Inyan and Yod there, after you've taken everything out of it, you've boiled up the whey, and you've taken everything out, you're left more or less with water. It's called mei cholov. Actually, very interesting machlokas rishonim. Some hold, and it's brought down the Yesh Oistrim in Shulchan Aruch, that it's a shayla Eva Minachai. There's no heter to have it, it's all Eva Minachai, it's like an Issa Doraisa. And others hold that it's milchik alkoholpon midrabonon, and we've asked him that it's milchik alkoholpon midrabonon. So if you make alcohol out of it, l'choyro, you have to treat it as milchik. And I told this very interesting discovery to Rav Lando, who is himself Lubavitch. And by the next morning when I came back to London, this whole rumour had already gone around the world that you must stop drinking vodka, because, which I don't agree with at all, because there's two factories I told you in the whole world. There's probably 10,000 other distilleries across the world, if not more, making alcohol. There's absolutely no reason to be choshish, unless you know there's no reason to be choshish that's coming. Well, it's a question, obviously, when we investigate, we always ask, what is the source of the alcohol? Time is very limited, so for the chidushim I can share with you in the next 5 minutes. One of the key ingredients which one always has to investigate, because it's flavors. Flavors are extraordinarily complex. We have a chemist, an expert in flavors, who works in my office, who investigates all the flavors. Flavors, a common flavor, can be something like 30, 40 different sub-ingredients. Very complex thing. Haven't really got a slide to show you, but just one example is a flavour which is called raspberry flavouring. Raspberry flavouring. So you look, what could be wrong with raspberry flavouring? You get the ingredients, get the print out, it says it's got four ingredients. Acacia solution, starch, it's a powder, so it's been spray dried, and it's used starch and acacia, and raspberry juice and raspberry oil. Sounds very, very innocent. But there's no such thing. If you're knowledgeable in the field, you have to know that you have to ask, now what are the sub-ingredients of each one of those? Raspberry oil doesn't mean they somehow extracted the oil from the raspberry, or even if they had, you'd like to know how. And in fact, the next slide I show 36 sub-ingredients for that raspberry, what they called raspberry oil. It's actually an artificial flavour, it's got 36 ingredients. the call whether any of them were kosher, any of them were problematic, non kosher, but you have to have somebody who knows what he's doing to investigate all these things. Another lovely example is the product we were making actually for Pesach, one of the ingredients was lime oil distilled. Sounds lime oil distilled, essential oil. How problematic could that be? And in fact, when asking for the formulation, it actually had a formulation of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of 9 different ingredients. The first one is lime oil. Lime oil comes in from Peru. The following are added to form a standard product. And then you've got alpha-terpeneic, alpha-terpenine, alpha-pinene, beta-pinene, linol, etc. One ingredient was aldehyde C10. And on the investigation of the aldehyde C10, it turned out that it came from, I think it was caproic acid or hexanoic acid, which was of animal origin. So something which looks entirely innocent could in fact have something of animal origin inside it. The second thing we investigate is process aids. What's called process aids. A classic example of a process aid is something like a release agent. A release agent is a fancy term for anybody making a cake. They use a fat to grease the tin. It's a release agent to help the product get released so it doesn't stick on. And in factories, particularly confectionery factories making sweets, let's say, which are sticky things made of sugar, you cannot afford to have even one sweet getting stuck in the line forming the sweets. One sweet gets stuck, then the whole line stops, 20 people get worked off, everybody goes off to have coffee and play table tennis while the engineers are called out to sort out the factory. They use copious amounts of release agent to make sure nothing sticks. Release agents, according to 1982 labeling regulations, do not have to be declared. They're not declared on the packaging, and therefore companies can get away with using all sorts of things. A release agent obviously is a fat, and it's one of the main things one has to check out very, very carefully. I once went into a factory, actually. You might just be able to... Okay. That's just an example of various different ways of how they might use release agents, just in a simple, old-fashioned kind of factory, greeting the table, first of all, because you have a big lump of essentially sugar, which has got flavours and colours in there, and then it's made into a long sausage roll, and all that equipment will be very carefully oiled beforehand, and then you have the chopper at the end, which actually chops out or forms the sweets, and these things have to be very well oiled. But I was going to share with you an instance, a very interesting instance, where I went into a factory making chocolate buttons, the sort of thing like chocolate buttons, and you coat them sometimes with a finish to make it like a Smartie, that type of material. And looking through the stores, the ingredients are absolutely straightforward. Do you use any process aids? No process aids, everything straightforward. And this is the kind of roller where the chocolate goes in, you'll see, and it forms the little buttons as the rollers turn. The rollers are cool, it's all a cold process, should be very straightforward. Going around the factory, I discovered glycerine, grams of glycerine of animal origin. Has to be checked out, could be animal, could be vegetable. Of animal origin, it's cheaper, so you have to be careful. In kind of sprays. What's this for? They say before we start the equipment in the morning, we spray all the equipment with glycerine because that stops condensation on the rollers, depending on the climate of winter's morning and such like, and stop condensate. So we have to spray with glycerine beforehand. A kind of release agent. I'll tell you one interesting story because there's so much potentially to talk about. But one very interesting story, you may have heard it before. It's worth repeating. It's what I like to refer to as the brown sugar scandal of 97. I went into a factory in 97, actually on behalf of the Grudzinskis in the good old days when they used to manufacture their own biscuits for Pesach, and they wanted to make brown sugar in bulk. I went to one of the British sugar factories and we checked out the brown sugar process. It was all very simple, very straightforward. And then we went across the road, this is in Bury St Edmunds, we went across the road to see the packing plant. Packing plant, very straightforward. As I go into the packing plant, I see drums of glycerine from Unikema, which I knew was the animal source. What's the drums of glycerine doing here? I thought they'd probably tell me it's for the pumps, because sometimes they use it in just as a release agent, effectively, just to make the pumps work well. And he said, we use that in the brown sugar. So we didn't use that in brown sugar. He didn't tell me to use it in the brown sugar. We've just been through the brown sugar process. He said, you were talking about the bulk sugar. We use this in the retail packs. Retail packs is even worse. Everybody's using retail packs of sugar, and they use it. How does that happen? And it's the most remarkable story. The factory across the road, the refinery, makes white sugar. Only white sugar. And here, if you go to Bury St Edmunds, you're going through the main road, you see at one point a massive platform coming across the road, and that is a conveyor belt about 2 meters wide, bringing sugar across the road on a conveyor into the packing plant. And here we've got about 6 mines, and one of them packs brown sugar. Comes across the road as white sugar, and hey presto, it gets packed as brown sugar. How does it change from white to brown? Most people think, and in many factories it is the case, that brown sugar is less refined and it's got more impurities on it, and therefore the colour is brown, and therefore it's supposed to be healthier for it. But what they do is they refine all their sugar and it's all white, and then when it comes across the road, in the packing unit, actually, they add molasses, which are the crude material which is taken off during the sugar process. They add molasses back to coat the outside of the sugar grain. If you take one of their sugar grains from British Sugar and cut it in half, you would actually find all white in the centre, and on the outer surface, it's got molasses. Molasses should be fine. But because the molasses are very sticky, and the sugar would go solid in the cupboard because the molasses would glue every single crystal to the next one, which is very often what happens, they dilute it down with glycerine. There were three different versions of what they made, and one of them was actually 60% glycerine animal to 40% molasses, and then every single piece of sugar gets coated with glycerine. So it's an extraordinary example of the problems that might occur. My time has unfortunately elapsed, even though I have these about 20 other examples, I think you're not going to fill the time. And if I'll just conclude by highlighting to you a remarkable Rashi, starting with a bit of Torah Torah, so we'll end with a bit of Torah Torah. Rashi says, Lahavdil ben atomei ben atoha, the end of this parsha in Shemini. He says the most interesting thing. Lahavdil, we all know what Lahavdil means. Says Rashi, Lahavdil, to distinguish between the tomei and the toha. Lo bilvad ha-shoina, ela shetehe yodea or makir or boki bohem. It's not enough. So I'm sure he was talking about to the modern 21st century kashrus. It's not enough to learn the basic halachos. Lo bilvad ha-shoina, ela shetehe yodea, you've got to be knowledgeable, or makir, and you have to be very, shall we say, observant, very professional, you have to know what you're seeing, or boki bohem, and you've got to be expert in them when it comes to the laws of kashrus. And the next Rashi also, lahavdil, tzorech loima, you have to ben tomin ha-toha, you make a havdola between tzorech loima ben tzvila aroid, between an ass and a deer. Everybody knows the deer is kosher and aroid is straight. What's lahavdil? What's that havdola you've got to make? Elo, lahavdil ben tomea aloch letahir aloch. That which is tomei for you, that which is toha for you, means ben nishchat chetzio shalkona, the nishchat rubo shalkona. The difference between shechting half the windpipe and rove of the windpipe, 50% or 51%. 50% is trace, 51% is kosher. The kamahi, mashahu. What's the difference between one of them and the other? Mashahu. We've got a special mitzvah of lahavdil, but even when it comes to a tiny detail, and mashahu in kashrus, that's the difference between tahir aloch and tamer aloch. We should be zeicher lahavdil ben atomer ben atoha, and to be mekayim b'tkadashtem v'yitzem kadoshim, and thereby rapidly bring the gula shleimah from heaven.